Three CLDs.
Susan Land, and hello here in Washington. Thanks for coming. We've got a really timely topic today because the moratorium on utility cutoffs by Lee Energies is ending soon. So I know everybody here in the court is bracing for this, and I am really, really pleased that we have Andy Helminiak, who has got experience in this, who's put together a great outline, and he's going to talk to us about the We Energies issue specifically. And Kirk Fiedewa is here, and he's going to talk in more general terms about emergency filings and what to keep in mind when somebody comes to you to file a bankruptcy and it's an emergency and they have to file it right away. So I really appreciate both these guys coming in. I'm standing for here. I appreciate both of them coming in to talk to us about this stuff this morning. Next month, April 12th, we're back on the second Tuesday. Nathan De La Durante and Heidi Miller are going to talk about the FDCPA. When bankruptcy doesn't stop them, turn to your remedies under the FDCPA. So I'm sure you all want to come back and hear about that. They've had some recent success in the district court here, and they'll tell you about that. We don't have a topic yet for May, so if you have something in mind, please let us know. If you're willing to share something like Nathan with his recent experience with the FDCPA litigation was willing to share that. If you've got something like that to share with the group, please. That's what makes this program successful. We'll set it up. We'll tell you what you need to do, and we would appreciate it. Also, if you look at the website, you'll see the date change for November. We're not going to come on Election Day. Too controversial. But we're going to go on November 1st with Supreme Court cases review preview, and then our ethics date. I want you to get those dates on your calendar so that we have a good turnout for our annual speakers at the end of the year. So again, today, so pleased to have this timely topic, We Energies and Emergency Filings, with Andy Helminiak and Kirk Fiedewa. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, Judge Kelly. I'm Andy Helminiak. I work at Stupar, Schuster, and Bartell. We do work for We Energies, and this is my first time actually down here. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I've meant to come a bunch of times, and this finally got me here, and I hope to come more in the future, so hopefully you'll be seeing me down here in the coming months. And so I basically just started, I took over this work from Todd Nelson. Our firm used to do a lot of the bankruptcy work and work with We Energies. So I've been doing this since about last June when he left the firm. And basically what we do, I gave one talk up at Kohler before too a couple of years ago, and what I found out from doing that talk is that a lot of the stuff that we do with We Energies is not the stuff that people deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I tried to, and when I gave that talk, people had a lot of questions that I did not have a lot of answers to. So this time I worked with their people who deal with this on a daily basis. So hopefully I can be a little more useful today than I was in Kohler a couple of years ago. So getting into the outline, basically the first part of this was just kind of to get me into things. What We Energies is defined as, of course, they're a public utility under the Wisconsin statutes, and basically what that means is they're regulated by the Public Service Commission. So if you're ever curious about want to find regulations to figure out why We Energies is doing what it is doing from a legal standpoint, basically just go right to the PSC. That's kind of their, the Public Service Commission rules that are in the Wisconsin Administrative Code. That's kind of their Bible. And a lot of stuff is laid out in there. It's a pretty big section of administrative rules. So, and then I've tried to print out the main ones that apply to disconnection, security deposits, things like that, to make them part of your outline, so that to make it a little less cumbersome for people. and just so you know, We Energies, I put in their service area there. Basically, they're provide all gas and electric. They provide both gas and electric service, which I'm sure you're aware of, through Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee counties, and then portions of Walworth, Jefferson, Sheboygan, Outagamie, Calumet, and Winnebago. So they're basically everywhere. And I guess the point is that if you're, you know, a large portion of your filings, debtors are going to be dealing with We Energies in one way or the other. So, you know, I guess this is of wide interest, and that's why. And then from We Energy's point of view, they have approximately 8,400 customer filings. They had that many in 2015, and I'm sorry, in 2015 and 2014, and they expect just as many in 2016. So it's a giant administrative task for them, too, dealing with bankruptcy filings and the issues involved in it. And I guess that number was a little surprising even to them, because the first person I talked to said, well, that can't be right, and then talked to her boss, and it was. So it's a big task for them. And then, so the period we're in now is governed by, I put the PSC codes there, and basically the time period we're in now is we're in cold weather rules for disconnection, which basically means under We Energy's policies, the only reasons they will disconnect during the winter is for safety reasons and for properties if they're residential. And what I'm talking about today is solely residential. Businesses have obviously less stringent disconnection rules because it's not the safety of individuals who have to live in a place that is involved, and that's the main concern for the PSC with winter disconnections. So the two reasons that We Energies will disconnect on residents in the winter are for safety reasons or if a property is confirmed vacant. So if someone is living in a property, they won't disconnect. I don't think the rules are quite that strict, but that's their policy. So then, of course, in the winter, you have the issue where people are not paying, you know, their energy bills for whatever reason, and then summer comes, or the spring comes along, and we have, you know, disconnections that will occur because of delinquencies. And just so you're aware, I put the period in there. Basically, the disconnection period starts on April 15th, and that's right in the Public Service Commission code. So that's where that is. And then November 1st is when disconnections stop in the winter. And then just so you're aware, if a resident is disconnected, We Energies is not required to reconnect by that November 1st deadline. They do have to personally visit every property to make sure to basically have a talk with the person or attempt to talk with the person who's inhabiting the property, make them aware of the safety issues involved, and urge that they either seek energy assistance or try to make payments or do whatever they can to get the energy back on. But so that's what they'll do in the winter. And then as far as disconnection rules for the rest of the year, what'll happen at this time of year is that a disconnection notice will go on a customer's bill, and We Energies will attempt to make a call to the customer as well to let them know that there's a possibility of disconnection. Once the bill hits the customer's, is delivered, the customer has 20 days to make payment arrangements or they will be disconnected. And if there's a prior disconnection on the customer's record, We Energies may disconnect as soon as 7 days after, so they'll accelerate the timeline for that. And then sometimes, depending on circumstances, if there's a separate disconnect notice sent, it may have a different timeline. So, you know, if a client or potential client has a, you know, separate letter that states a specific disconnection time or date, refer to that rather than just a 20-day deadline. But the general rule is that they'll have 20, you know, a customer will have 20 days to contact We Energies after they receive the notice on their bill. And then the next thing is that I think I'm going to kind of skip number two and go to number three. I think I put that kind of out of order on my outline. I'm on page three. And this is something that Kirk asked me when we were discussing our outlines. Is basically, he asked, well, a lot of times we'll have people come in, you know, when they receive this disconnection notice, and, you know, are there alternatives to bankruptcy that we can tell them about? Because, say, if they have, right, he said, like a $700 past due bill, and they have $300, and that's their only reason for filing, what are some alternatives? And I think the number one, there are two questions I think that people should be asked. Number one, have they called We Energies and tried to talk to them about this? We Energies, they have extra hours of, I put a couple numbers down here. What my contact told me is that people will receive the best offer that they can get simply by calling this automated line, this 800-842-4565. And it's just an automated, you put in your amount of past due and it'll make you an offer. So there's no financial analysis of your circumstances or anything. It's just based on the bill. If you want to talk to a person, I have the 800 number there. That's specifically for payment plans, disconnection, financial issues, nothing else. So that's what the operators there are trained to deal with. And they have extended hours, I believe starting at, well, when the moratorium ends, so April 15th and onward. They're 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday and 8 a.m. 5 p.m. on Saturday. So then they can actually talk to a person, explain circumstances, and see what We Energies can do for them. The other alternative, which is a good alternative to ask people about, and I had some handouts in the back, is about energy assistance. And basically, if someone is up to two times of the poverty level, their household income is up to two times the poverty level, they can qualify for energy assistance. And that's run through each county's Department of Health and Human Services. I put the handout is for Milwaukee specifically. I kind of looked around online a little bit and found for Racine and Kenosha counties and things. So the information's out there. And if the people, you know, up to two times the poverty level, they can qualify for energy assistance, and that basically helps them make payments in the winter time. And if you'll notice, I believe, sorry, I forgot to keep one of the handouts for myself, but basically, thank you. it's available, I believe, through May. So even though we're not, you can apply through May 15th. Though we're not in the winter period, the people can apply for energy assistance. And that will help them, because if you have applied for energy assistance and received energy assistance in the past 18 months, you will not be, the person will not be, We Energies will not disconnect them.
They have to go to a place to and meet with someone? Is that, I think I've heard this before from people, that some of their clients, they do not want to go to a place and sit and wait in a line to talk about energy assistance. They would just rather file bankruptcy. Does that happen, Tim?
Not to your
clients. You've got the better quality.
They usually go before they come, and there's either not enough assistance.
Okay.
That's going to work for them.
Okay.
So they don't do that.
So it is a viable program, but it might not offer enough relief for somebody that's really in a hole.
Okay.
I'm curious about that, Andy.
Right, and you do have to go in person, and it tells you what you need to bring, and if I'm. And I guess the point is, even if it's not enough assistance for a person, stops disconnection. So that's, you know, that's a positive right there. so those are the basic alternatives. So if a person does decide that bankruptcy is the correct, you know, the appropriate option for them, and they file. If they file prior to disconnection, obviously We Energies gets a notice from the court. They generally get the notice from the attorney or from the person as well. We Energies will verify all notices it gets that are not from the court to make sure they're actual notices. If there is an active disconnection in place, that stops the disconnection immediately. And then the customer's account is stopped as of the date of the filing, and a new post-petition account is set up for the debtor. So that's how that works. And then, of course, once you're in bankruptcy, the other thing, when a bankruptcy is filed, if the person is disconnected, they will be able to have reconnection the following day after the filing. they have to call and set up an appointment with We Energies, and it's a 12-hour appointment. It's 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Any member of the household who's 18 or older can be there for the appointment, so it's flexibility of that way, but it is a 12-hour appointment that they have to be available for. So once in bankruptcy, obviously the bankruptcy code controls and utility service is under 11 U.S.C. 366. It's a short section. I didn't include the whole thing in here. The main thing is that We Energies cannot alter, refuse, or disconnect service to or discriminate against the debtor solely on the basis of a filing of bankruptcy. So they can't discriminate. But then the utility also has the ability to collect a deposit within 20 days after the filing of the bankruptcy for adequate assurance of payment during the bankruptcy. And then we did have, this was back in 2008, I think, there were a couple of litigated matters actually in Judge Kelly's court regarding the deposits. One had to do, this In Re Canon was about basically that this person was under the federal poverty, 200% of the federal income poverty guidelines, and that basically there's a public service commission code right on point that says that deposits aren't required for people under 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, and that kind of that dovetails with the energy assistance program. And basically that's how We Energies will track if someone is 200% or under of the federal poverty guidelines. Is, you know, at that point they should be asking for energy assistance. That's the easy way for We Energies to track it. If they haven't for some reason applied for energy assistance and they're in a bankruptcy and they're below that threshold, I don't think a deposit should be charged, but at that point they should be, you know, looking at energy assistance as an option anyway. And then the other case on deposits, which is kind of interesting as well, is this In Re Price, and this is on the, I put the link on there to the Eastern District website where that opinion is. And basically, if someone who's charged a deposit doesn't think it's an appropriate deposit, they can argue about the reasonableness of this and the deposit, and I think that's what Price did. And Judge Kelly came up with an analysis of the reasonable deposit for a case and looked at the time of the year the case was filed, disconnection, the timing of disconnection, and the debtor's representation of what they could afford. Which is, it's kind of interesting because the bankruptcy, this was a Chapter 7 filed in spring, so for the bankruptcy, you're looking at a time frame of 3 to 4 months over the summer months where the utility will need adequate assurance of payment. Generally, what We Energy looks at for its deposits, which I'll get into down below next in the outline, is they're looking at when they assess a deposit on a person normally, it's the deposit is assessed for an entire year, and they want adequate assurance of payment for that entire year. So when a deposit is assessed and paid, it's kept for a year. There are provisions about the deposit has to earn interest. So what will happen in a case is that I'll just get into deposit letters because it dovetails with this pretty well. When a case is filed on the debtor's next bill, if they are required to pay a deposit, that deposit it will state that on the next bill. And there are two instances in which a debtor does not have to pay a deposit. That is when the debtor is current on all their bills prior to the filing of the bankruptcy, and then if they have received energy assistance within the last 18 months. So that's when they will not get a deposit letter. If they do get a deposit, if they're notified that We Energies needs a deposit. So debtor files, their next bill will state that they owe a deposit. They will have 20 days from the receipt of that bill to make arrangement on the deposit. We Energies will give them as much as 3 months. They'll spread the deposit out over three payments, allow them to pay over 3 months. So that's one thing that they can do to spread out the cost. But then again, when the deposit is collected by We Energies, they will keep the deposit for 12 months, and this is pursuant to the code. And then if there are any untimely payments during that 12 months, the clock starts over, and so a deposit could be kept for theoretically a longer period of time if there are missed payments during the 12 months or delinquent payments.
So if I can understand this, if they come to file a bankruptcy on We Energies, and that's what they all say, I just want to file on We Energies, and of course we know you have to include all your creditors, but if that's your main reason for filing, whatever, they should be away, and they're not under the poverty guideline, because you still have to apply that, right? You can't get
correct.
A deposit out of somebody that's under 200% of the federal poverty. So if they're above that and they file bankruptcy, they should be aware that their next bill not only is going to have, it's not going to have the old discharge stuff on it, but it's going to have their post-petition utility charges and a deposit.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Does that deposit get applied to missed payments if they miss payments during the year, or is it just something that gets held?
It's something that generally is held. If an account is closed or moved for some reason, it will be applied. I can look in more into the rules about that. I didn't ask exactly when it would be applied afterwards, but I know a lot of times they hold them.
Okay.
And I think the main concern, and the other thing with the deposit, is the deposit's generally charged by We Energies. Their policy is to charge the deposit for the highest 2 months in the previous year, even if it is a spring bankruptcy filing, because like I said, they're planning to hold the deposit for the entire year, keep it as adequate, you know, basically for protection for payment for them for the winter time. So they're looking, when assessing the deposit, more at the PSC than at the bankruptcy itself, if that makes sense. So that's the amount, I guess, you can expect in the deposit. So it will be a higher amount based upon the winter month bills. So that's the deposits. And then basically after post-petition, once the deposit is assessed, the debtor's account is treated like any other new account. In Chapter 7, We Energy simply monitors to see when the discharge occurs or dismissal. When the discharge occurs, they'll simply discharge the pre-petition debt, and the debtor has a new account, and they, you know, go around the other side of bankruptcy.
Do they keep track of the dismissals too, Andy? Are they...
They do. That's one of the things I was going to talk about next, is they're not, the dismissals, if it's a dismissal and then a repeat filer,
right.
That's one of the big issues they have. They try to track it. It's hard for them to track, and that's a lot of times when we get involved, when you have someone who has, and we don't generally get involved until someone has filed 4 or 5 times. They do try to track dismissals and stay on top of that, because that's obviously a problem for them, as people who file repeatedly to try to make it to the next winter moratorium without paying their bills.
What about a close without discharge? We see some of those as well. Are they tracking those?
I do not believe so.
Okay.
It's hard for them to track. I think the main thing they're looking for is the discharge.
Right.
And if they get a discharge, then obviously they just wipe away all the old debt.
Right.
If they don't get a discharge, it stays out there. But as far as how efficient they are about kind of putting that back together on the bills, hard to say.
Yeah.
I mean, my understanding is that's one of the things that's a difficulty for them, that they struggle with, and they're working to get a more efficient system. So that's kind of the short answer to that. And that's why the repeat filing is one of the concerns that they wanted me to talk about from their point of view. Because I think the big thing we had back in 2008 to 2010 is the 128 issue, which I think most people are probably aware of, where a lot of individuals and some attorneys, a couple attorneys were filing these Chapter 128s in Wisconsin because We Energies had a policy not to disconnect during a Chapter 128. And these cases were just kind of allowed to languish in state court. Basically, it would kind of appoint the attorney or the debtor would appoint kind of a zombie trustee and not notify this trustee that the case was even going on. The judges assumed the trustee was looking over the case. No trustee looking over the case. So literally these cases would sit there for a year or more. And these people would not get disconnected. They wouldn't be paying. And basically no one was minding the store. It was a huge mess to clean up. And there were literally hundreds of cases in state court that we had to clean up. And then there was a decision that came out of there that basically We Energies, a Chapter 128 stay does not preclude a disconnection by We Energies. So that kind of solved that problem, among other things. And I talked to We Energies. They see very few Chapter 128s anymore. So their problem now is just repeat filings. I don't think it's nearly as big of an issue. Essentially what
maybe not for you.
Right, for them. I mean, so it's in the court too?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have to get more on top of this.
Yeah.
Too. All right. Well, I will let them know that it bothers you as much as it bothers them. that's good to know because it bothers them a lot. And they're working on, getting more efficient at stopping this. But I think that, and then the only thing they do is on repeat filers is you have the section of the automatic stay where they lose the repeat filers lose the automatic stay after 30 days and they'll file comfort orders or it never takes effect. I think they like to get the comfort orders because I think there's law out there, some law that 366 is a little different from the automatic stay, so they want to make sure that that applies. But that's basically, I think the problem is they have 8,400 cases a year that they're tracking and they have a lot of things to deal with, and it's an administrative issue for them like it is for the courts probably, and
right.
They'll work together on that.
Right, we do.
To figure it out.
And our problem, it's not these guys that are and gals that are
right.
Representing them. If they're coming in pro se, they can't navigate it. They don't understand, even with the easier plain English schedule forms, the pro se's are still unable to really get it done without help. And if the trustee, if the court's now got a pro se a coordinator, a pro se law clerk to try to help these folks to the extent we can, maybe the trustee will take pity on them and help them kind of navigate the system, and then they, if they get their pay their filing fee and get their discharge next year, what happens? They still don't have the resources to pay the We Energies, and back they come. So it is a problem, and not necessarily by the attorneys, although it affects them because their paying clients are being adversely affected while the court is clogged with these pro se's. But
okay. So this is just the pro se filers, or this is their way of dealing with their energy bills?
Yes. Yes. So we think you should let them file in 128. That would be fine with us.
Require it.
Yeah. I'm going to issue a decision that says 128 does apply to stop We Energy. How about that?
They would love that. We'll work on it. I will let them know. I didn't know how big of an administrative issue it was for the courts as well, but it's a thorn in their side, and it's something they're working to track better is all I can say at this point from We Energy's point of view.
Right.
They wanted me to complain about that more than I did. I think they were closer to your attitude about it that they just, it irritates the heck out of them.
Right. Well, if there are resources that we can point these folks to, whether it's the first time they file, we cannot stop somebody from filing bankruptcy. And I know that there's some philosophical differences but among the folks that, say, work at the pro se help desk and even among the judges about whether our job is to stop them and educate them and say, no, this is a bad idea. You don't need a bankruptcy. There's other resources for you to deal with We Energies. My personal philosophy is not to try to stop them, but by all means, if we can show them other resources are available, that's what we want to be able to do and have the information at the court, at the 341 meetings, wherever it might be helpful to point them to.
Mm-hmm. There may not be much philosophical
anymore. There isn't maybe?
Disharmony anymore.
But if it does, I mean, the worst case scenario is they do make it through the seven. And again, it's not usually because they were able to navigate it on their own. It's because of pro se help desk. It's because the trustee, you know, helping them, looking at the schedules and saying, you didn't take any exemptions. Do you really, you know, you want to take, you exempt your clothes, right? I mean, I think that's what you're doing, Titania, stuff like that, and helping them through. It's that person that gets through, gets the discharge, and now next year, or maybe they make it 1 year, I don't know, but the second year, they're back. And now they can't file the seven. And now somebody says, well, you can file 13. And now they come into 13, and that's just a nightmare. They cannot navigate it. We don't help them at the pro se help desk. We can't. You can't help somebody for free for a 3-year plan. You can't. We get that. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's education. What are the resources out there? What are the non-bankruptcy answers for these kind of people?
I agree, and I guess I'm part of coming here was, like I said, we don't deal a lot until we see the big issues, and I think it's a good thing to have communication on these issues and tell. I mean, because I don't know how much direct communications We Energies has with the court. Probably, I mean, on issues at all, probably not a lot.
Well, we've invited them in and had them come and talk to us, and I think as a result of one of those interactions, they stopped cutting everybody off on April 15th, even though they can. They more made it a rolling date, and that helps us a lot, because now we get it spread out over a longer period. It's just impossible for us to navigate if 30 people come to the court to say, I want to file bankruptcy on We Energies, 30 people at 10 o'clock on April 14th. That's problems.
Sure.
So now it's rolling, and I think Janet told me that may have been instituted after a We Energies representative came and talked to us. But
because I think probably everyone here will have somebody show up at their door and say, I owe We Energies, I'm disconnected, shut me off, or you know, let me file bankruptcy because I owe them $1,500 and that's all I owe. And that's not a good solution for them. So, I mean, it may be their only solution, but it's really not a good use of bankruptcy code or their rights under bankruptcy.
Because what will happen, and if I was the kind of person that would want to talk them out of it, I would say, maybe in a couple years, you're going to need a bankruptcy and not be able to file one because you file now. If you get a job and everything, you build up some assets, and you need a bankruptcy, it's not going to work for you because you filed now and you can't file for 8 years. So it's best if we can steer them away until they need it for some legitimate reason other than getting their utilities turned back on, although that's a scary prospect for people. But if there's other ways, if there's energy assistance, if there's get on a payment plan, I don't have. Has anybody in the audience come up with other creative ways to help them? No? other than these that are being talked about? Okay.
I know legal aid helps about 30 a year, approximately, depending on how much they owe. They won't take the cases where they owe thousands of dollars, several thousands. But if it's a manageable amount, anywhere from $700 to $1,500, and they otherwise qualify, legal aid does help about 30 a year. I know that's not a big amount, but it's...
Right. Okay, so there's an idea. If somebody's got a manageable amount, you could refer them to legal aid. Karen, I think, is the gal over there. Karen Bauer.
Yeah.
Bob?
Yeah, Andy, I'm looking at page 5 of your outline. It says, excluding reintroduce from the case does not work.
We all have people that walk in our office and they owe $400, $500. The deposit's going to be $1,000.
Right.
And they already said, well, I've got arrangements with reintroduce. I'm working it out.
Okay.
We don't put it in the bankruptcy. I mean, technically we should. It's discharged anyway, pursuant to her case, but... And I don't think I've ever had anyone come back to me and say I got a notice saying I got to pay a deposit.
What Reenergy's told me is basically there are cases where, and I don't know if it's, I guess I don't know the specific cases that you know you've dealt with, but where people will not include Reenergy's in their petition because they do not want to be charged the deposit, even though they are, you know, if they're above poverty level or above. If they haven't received energy assistance, they're above 200% of the poverty level, they're past due on bills, they don't want to pay the deposit in the case, Reenergies will find those. I think they do basically customer searches. I don't know how they do it, but they've they'll assess the deposit after the case is filed. They will have attorneys call them or debtors call them and say, hey, I didn't include you in my case. You can't charge me a deposit. And if that's the case, Reenergies will still assess the deposit because it's, I think under 366, they basically are entitled to once the case is filed.
Plus, you can't actually do that, although I appreciate there's not really any policing mechanism.
Right. So that's what, and I don't know if people, I mean, sure, I guess what you're saying is people get away with it.
Yeah, there's no policing mechanism.
Right.
Well, if it's a small amount and, you know, one, their last bill, and technically when they file, they do have some pre-petition, but they're really not in default. Is that what you're talking about?
Or they've made arrangements.
Oh, they've made
behind,
arrangements.
But they made arrangements to pay it in installments, and Reenergies have said, okay, fine, do it that way.
Okay.
And I'll say, okay, we won't put it in, and I've yet to have anyone come back and say, I got a deposit letter.
Okay, I guess I'm not...
Tell him that.
Right.
You can move on.
I suspect with the 8,000 cases, they're not going to go try and look for it. There's bigger problems.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
Is it like if you have a bill over $600, you're going to be facing a disconnect? Is there a baseline number? They would not share with me any of the numbers. So, yeah, sorry.
I think we've been told by Reenergies that it's $400, at least as of a year or two ago. So.
Yeah, last year I know it was
$450,
and the year before it was like $600, so I was just curious.
I will go back and ask them.
Okay.
But they wouldn't give me the numbers, so.
And you want to secretly email me?
Sure.
secretly email him on the listserv.
I won't tell anyone.
Great.
Okay.
Do you want to
sure.
talk about some other kinds of emergencies?
Yeah. So we have people come into your office and say, I have a deadline. I need to file bankruptcy right away, and so I need to file an emergency petition. And why would that be? So I think the biggest one is last-minute retention is counsel, because if it's not last-minute, you probably shouldn't be filing it as an emergency. But the last-minute retention is counsel, and then some sort of immovable deadline. Reenergies is the relevant one for kind of what we're talking about today. But other ones, foreclosure deadlines, car repossessions, garnishments, levies of assets, suspensions of driver's licenses or registrations of cars, all reasons. I'm sure there's more. Those are the ones that came to mind offhand. Doing so, filing an emergency petition before we've had a chance to put everything together, certainly creates some risks for the debtors. Just general risks, they're probably going to have to pay an amendment fee to add creditors later on, because rarely do they bring everything to you ahead of time for all the creditors. There also is the inability to do exemption planning, the inability to affect the discharge of certain debts. I think the biggest one of those would be taxes, especially with like the We Energy shutoff being on April 15th as tax day. A lot of times, if somebody waits a couple days or a couple weeks, they may have taxes that could get discharged, and a week in the dark is probably worth having those taxes discharged. So it's harder to figure out what those deadlines are on an emergency basis. There's also the shortened time frame to file schedules, or the completed schedules. You only have 14 days to do that after the case is filed, unless you're able to show cause, which we'll talk about in a little bit later. And then there's uncertainty about passing the means test if you don't have all their information about how much money they make as you're putting it together. There's also, for filing Chapter 7, the inability to voluntarily dismiss the case once you're in it, in case they do have assets that they don't tell you about at your initial conference, and that can get them or your clients not very happy, which isn't terribly surprising. Now, there's also risks for filing emergency petitions as the bankruptcy attorney. There's malpractice claims if you haven't disclosed and made your clients aware of all of the risks that they might have, particularly with their inability to get out of a Chapter 7 and the ability, the fact that they'll probably lose assets if they have some that could be retained or liquidated by a trustee. There's also two places, well, one in the statutes and one in the rules. There's Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Procedure 9011B with representations to the court and what your signing of the petition actually means that you have done. So the rule states that by presenting to the court a petition, by presenting to the court a petition, an attorney is certifying that, to the best of that person's knowledge, information and belief informed after a reasonable inquiry under the circumstances, that the petition is not being presented for any improper purpose, the claims and other legal contentions therein are warranted by existing law, and that the allegations and other factual contentions have evidentiary support. So that's what your signature on the petition says. Also, 707B4C and D talks about the attorney's signature on a petition, and that is that the signature on the petition shall constitute a certification that the attorney has performed reasonable investigation into the circumstances that gave rise to the petition, determined that the petition is well-grounded in fact and is warranted by existing law, and then D, the signature of the attorney on the petition shall constitute a certification that the attorney has no knowledge after an inquiry that the information in the schedules filed with such petition is incorrect, which is, I think, kind of daunting, and it creates, especially in the emergency context, I think it creates two affirmative responsibilities that we have. One, it's we have to make sure that the petition is filed in good faith, and two, I think it gives us a responsibility to make sure that the client has told us about everything, that we know what's all going on in the case, and it's not just, oh, we're going to fix this one problem without looking at the whole rest of the situation and knowing what's all going on for the debtor and why they're filing. So there are sanctions for those two. Rule 9011C1A provides a bit of a safe haven, except where you can fix the documents that you filed, except that it specifically excludes the filing of the petition as the safe haven. So there's no relief there. The sanctions in Rule 9011C2, they're limited to whatever is sufficient to deter the repetition of such conduct or comparable conduct, and it can consist of directives of non-monetary nature in order to pay a penalty to the court, or to pay to another party if somebody else brings a motion for a violation of that rule. And then 707B4B also has the ability for the court to assess sanctions either on the motion of a party in interest or on its own motion. or its own short order to show cause. And that payment can be to the court or to the trustee or U.S. trustee in the 707B context. So that obligation that we have to make sure that the case is filed in good faith, the Seventh Circuit tells us what good faith filing of a case is in the matter of love. It's 1357 F. 2nd, 1350, in the Seventh Circuit, 1992. That case is about a debtor who filed, I think, somewhere in Indiana, if I remember correctly. He was a tax protester and had not paid his property or income taxes for several years. At some point in time, he decided that he was not going to be a tax protester and filed Chapter 13 to pay off at least part of the tax debt. His case got dismissed for bad faith by the bankruptcy court because it was treating the IRS unfairly, and it paid part of the tax debt, but the priority portions, but not the unsecured portions that could have gotten discharged. And so the district court affirmed, and it went to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit declined to give any precise definition of a good faith filing and adopted a totality of the circumstances test to determine whether a case is filed in good faith or bad faith. It placed the burden of the proof on the creditor to prove that it's in bad faith, but the question basically boils down to, is the filing fundamentally fair in a manner that complies with the spirit of the Bankruptcy Code's provisions? And the inquiry is both subjective and objective. And they give several non-exhaustive factors that should be considered, all of which point to the need of a bankruptcy attorney to know why the case is being filed, because if you don't know the answers to all these, you can't know the answers to these without doing a pretty thorough investigation with your client. Though that list is the nature of the debt, whether the debt would be non-dischargeable in Chapter 7, the timing of the petition, how the debt arose, the debtor's motives in filing the petition, the debtor's actions, how they affected the creditors, and the debtor's treatment of the creditors both before and after the petition was filed, and then whether the debtor has been forthcoming to the court and to the creditors. So in order to figure out whether the case is in good faith, you have to look at all of those sorts of things. The other case we're going to look at is In re Moffitt, which comes out of the Central District of Illinois. And that was an emergency petition that got filed. And this talks about the debtor's attorney not doing the job that they should have been doing in order to figure out, what all needs to be in the schedules and what all is going on in the case. The debtor came to the attorney's office, talked to a paralegal, filled out an inquiry sheet. The inquiry sheet got put somewhere which never got looked at by the debtor's attorney. The debtor was told, just give us a list of creditors and pay our fees and take the credit counseling class and we'll file your case. And it was told that by the paralegal, not by the attorney. The attorney never met with the debtor before they filed the case, and they just they filed it as an emergency petition. On the inquiry sheet, the debtor had disclosed that she had a structured settlement of about $55,000 and had some pending litigation with an ex-spouse over some personal injury claims, but they got missed because the attorney never looked at the invoice or the inquiry sheet, and so the case, they never got disclosed until the 341 meeting where the debtor testified about them in front of the trustee. The trustee filed a non-dischargeability action, got the discharge pulled, and then the court, on its own motions, issued an order to show cause to see why the debtor's attorney shouldn't be sanctioned for not having known about any of this and not having disclosed it. And I think the relevant language to us is the attorney cannot absolve himself of the duty to conduct a reasonable investigation by affirmatively allowing clients to bring in only the bare minimum of information and then claiming that it's not his fault that he did not have sufficient information to review. Implicit in the statutory obligation to do a reasonable investigation is the obligation to require clients to provide the information necessary to do that investigation. The debtor's attorney was then suspended from using CMS or their electronic filing system for 6 months and only could be reinstated after taking a bunch of CLEs. So that gets us to what are the best practices for filing an emergency petition? What sort of things should we be doing? I think the first one is meet with the client. Don't have your staff do it, which seems obvious. But also, the attorney should be the one who meets with the clients and goes over the fee arrangement. and discloses all of the risks of filing an emergency petition, because I think they have the, we have the obligation to make sure that our clients know what they're getting into, especially in filing a Chapter 7 case. And especially because filing in Chapter 7, the sorts of things that are risky to clients are also the sorts of things that normally aren't included in our fee arrangements. So if the trustee comes up with stuff, then they're going to have to find a way to pay us all more money to defend those actions because they're out of the ordinary. So that kind of double problem, I think, gives us even a greater affirmative duty to make sure that we know what's going on and we don't get our clients into that situation. Also, Ken, we talked about the deadlines for filing, or how the filing date affects taxes and other creditors and claims for dischargeability issues. We should probably make sure we tell them about that. It gets us into the reasonable investigation of the client's situation. Probably confirmed that the immovable deadlines that the client thinks that they have are real. Oftentimes you'll have someone say, I need to file right away because my house is being foreclosed. Well, there's a lot of different deadlines in that process, and where are we? What's the actual deadline? Make sure you know that. You should run a credit report to try to get the whole, all the information about the client that you can get, and then check PACER to see if there are any previously filed cases. You need to know whether the debtor is even eligible to be in a Chapter 7 or in a Chapter 13. I need to find out about the automatic stay to see whether that needs to be extended or imposed, and then see if the debtor's or if your client's case has had a previous case being dismissed in the last, or I think ever, for not paying the filing fee, because if so, the court's not going to let you extend the filing fee and pay it in installments. I believe it's 14 days, correct? They have to pay it in or the case will get dismissed again.
If it's in the order dismissing the last case, then that's what's going to happen.
Okay. Then for Chapter 13 cases, I think you need to confirm that your client actually has the ability to make payments, that, or at least has the ability to receive the income to make payments, that it's likely that they'll be able to find a job. And then you review the sorts of assets and transfers that could be pursued by the trustee after filing in Chapter 7, and then really hold your whole interview with the client like you would, whether it's an emergency petition or not, so that you know what's going on. There's some things to confirm, like whether the car liens have been perfected, if it's possible to look at mortgage documents to make sure those have been timely recorded and perfected, whether there's UCC filings, whether there are tax warrants and levies against property, and then always important to ask your client whether they're going to receive an inheritance or they expect to receive an inheritance in the near future. They're also, because of the increased deadlines or the shortened deadlines to file completed schedules afterwards, you need to talk to your clients to make sure that they're going to get you all the information that you need so that you can do that. And you should review if you think you're going to need more time, you should review that with them and what is needed to get that. Judge Helfinger has a case in Ray Brown where he said, you know, you need to show cause. It's not the rules require that you show cause. It's not just ask for more time and we'll give it to you. You actually have to show the reason why you need to have more time, and getting documents, and just because it takes a while for the clients to put the documents together, at least it seemed to me from your order, didn't seem like that really is good enough cause to do that. Although maybe,
yeah, I mean, so to say something about it, I mean, there are some motions, I don't see many of these anymore, that wouldn't state any reason whatsoever and would just say, you know, need more time. I'm not even sure I would say we need more time, but essentially that was the ask. No one stated any reason, so I was like, well, you know, the rule says you need to show something. So it's, I have to say that, you know, the showing of cause on these, you know, I take people at their word, and it's usually something like, you know, people can't meet with us until now, until such and such a date, or, I mean, it's not like, it's not usually any a very elaborate thing, it's just I'm looking for, you know, something. But if, obviously, if it goes down, it's sort of a sliding scale, right? And so the longer it goes, the more sort of good reason you have to have. It's just, you know, is there a decent reason? And then sort of longer, the more cost of the delay, then the better the reason has to be. I just don't want to, you know, have too much. It needs to be something like really, there's sort of, you know, there's cause and there's cause. It sort of depends on the rest of the circumstances.
We don't need pages, just a reason. Yeah.
Look, a reason needs to be there.
All right. Then, let's see here. After filing, make sure that you give the creditor notice for the reason that you did file the emergency petition, so that, you know, if you don't tell Wii Energies that you filed, they're still going to disconnect your notice, and that doesn't really help your client. Or they're still going to disconnect your electricity, and that doesn't help your client a whole lot. And then, lastly, you should never file a case without having the wet signature or making sure that your clients actually signed the petition. And that takes us to In re Wenk, which is kind of a sad story out of the Eastern District of Virginia. The debtor's attorney had met with the client a couple of times, but had never had the petition signed. There was a snowstorm, apparently, right before the deadline for the foreclosure, and so he couldn't get her to come in and sign the petition. He then filed it as an emergency petition and put in that she had actually signed it. Unbeknownst to him, she went to another attorney because she couldn't get a hold of him and filed the petition with somebody else. And they filed them within an hour of each other on the same day. And so the court unsurprisingly sanctioned the first attorney, and he made a few excuses that he was trying to help his client and all of that, which, you know, made sense. But the court found that affixing an electronic signature to a petition or a document without having the client actually sign the petition or the document is forging a signature and violates Rule 9011 and Rule 1008. And I just want to point you to our local rules, which Rule 1008 and Rule 5005-1A, which kind of say the same thing. They require that you have that the documents are actually signed and that you keep the wet signatures in case they need to be looked at.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much. Okay, wonderful. Please come back next month for on April 12th for Nathan and Heidi's talk on the FDCPA, the claims that you can raise on behalf of your clients there. Thanks again, guys. Great.